I'm Rich Stewart, and this session is entitled, what is it entitled? Other Economic Alternatives, after talking about supply side last night. The basis for this particular lecture discussion is a book by Mark Green, who also I don't believe is an economist, but has written an awful lot about the governmental system. He's a Washington-based writer. His last book was Who Runs Congress? Now that he may know, maybe we ought to read his other book. This is a brand new book. It was foreword is dated January 1982, which says how new it was. I was introduced to it by the March or April issue of Mother Jones Magazine, which is one of those weird leftist magazines that's kind of out in nowhere land. Mother Jones is a real person, ironically enough. She was a suffragette. And it's kind of an intriguing magazine, which does an awful lot of writing in the left wing. But that particular issue brought together, and I should have brought it over, because it has pictures of several of the new wave economists who are trying to figure out what it is that we're going to be doing post-Reaganomics. A couple of quips last week said, you know, is there a post-Reaganomics? I think in terms of trying to find some of the books, that was one of the more difficult things. I ended up not only writing to publishers, I ended up calling publishers because I started getting desperate because I couldn't find any of these things. I only found one in our public library, which may say something about the public library system and the way in which they buy books. And the others were available sometimes depending upon the professor's buy list for classes at university libraries and bookstores. So I tried all 7 universities in our area and struck out. And then I called University of Pennsylvania and Temple and struck out. But I got lucky. Two major bookstores in Philadelphia. So I did some time wandering through their hallways and found 2 of the books I was looking for. And ironically enough, this one I found at the bookstore at the Philadelphia airport. Of all the weird places to find this book, right? I mean, this is after checking like 9 bookstores in Philadelphia, because I spent a whole day just kind of wandering around the city because I had some meetings there. So I went in early on a flight rather than late and literally spent my time walking from bookstore to bookstore to bookstore. But on the way out, my last stop, Mother Bookstore, why not? You know, I've been doing it already. And it's proved to be one of the more fruitful books that I've been reading about economics. At least from my political perspective. Some people said I did a good job of presenting George Gilder without a whole lot of prejudice. If that's what you feel, I'm glad you feel that way, because that's what I was trying to do. What I try and do when I do that is report what the author is saying and try and do it as clearly as possible in my words, translating his words. I've had some real problems with Gilder. There are ways in which you can read his book and call him racist, sexist, but there's a kernel of truth to what he has to say in terms of a critique about American lifestyle. The problem is I want to buy into the critique, but I'm not sure I want to buy into the diagnosis and the cure for the disease. Because some of the things he says are things that other economists are saying across the board. Mark Green, on the other hand, quotes a lot of different folks. He runs up and down the whole mill. I can probably give you a list of the names. For an economic student, they might be familiar, they might not. But Thoreau, Scheer, I was surprised he does not touch Hazel Henderson at all. I think she's a pariah in the economics world. That's the one book I have not completed, so I'm not going to talk much about her. But Hazel Henderson is a futurist coming out of Orlando, or not Orlando, but Jacksonville, Florida. And she is off the wall. She's a British. She's into sun and solar energy. And her only training is British equivalent of high school. But she has read numerous volumes, and she has been out on the lecture circuit. And the last time I had direct contact with her, she was doing economic development in terms of a presentation at the conference sponsored by the National Council of Churches this past November in Cleveland. When she talks about economics, she also does things in terms of the anti-nuclear movement and the way in which rock bands have some kinds of creative ways in which they talk about things that affect people. Most economists avoid those kinds of other connections, but Hazel's not afraid of those. She's a neat lady, and if you ever get a chance to hear her, go listen. You may not like what you hear, but go listen.
She's written books.
She's written 2 books. Caught me off guard, because one of which I have with me. It's a library book. I renewed it the day before we left so I could reduce the fine when I got home. Alternative Futures is one. And this one, the latest one is on economics, but I cannot remember the exact title of it. But you'll see me wandering around with it the rest of the next 2 weeks, because that's my fun reading. I don't think I'll do a lecture on it. But let me get into Mark Green and Winning Back America. Understand that he bounces from a lot of different economic theoreticians. The one caveat that you might want to remember throughout all of what I say is that no one cause has got us to where we are now, and thus no one solution will probably get us out. So you take that kind of caveat. All the things that I say are multiple things. And how his prescription for winning back America may involve some of them, part of them, all of them, depends upon the issue and where we are. His basic premise is that we need to have economic democracy. Economic democracy in the workplace. It is something like the experiment in Springfield, Ohio, where the garbage men negotiated a no-hours contract. They could go in at 5 o'clock in the morning, collect garbage as fast as they could, and once they were done for the day, they were done for the day. The experiment has worked. That they now end up being off 2.5 to 3 hours early. They don't take the full 8 hours to do a day. And the residents of the city have started to say that the garbage pickup has been better. So they work at their own pace. They work their own hours. GM has done some experimentations with quality of life. One of the places is in Pontiac, Michigan, when they developed their new, I can never remember the initials as to which car they produce up there, but it's the Oldsmobile plant was totally retooled. And in terms of asking the workers on the line how was the best way to put that car together as opposed to what the engineers designed on the drawing board, and they did honor the suggestions placed into the hopper by the employees, the people who were on the line putting the nuts and bolts together. They find it's one of the more efficient plants in the whole GM system now, because the workers had a say in how they were going to be managed. Another place in which economic democracy should have a role is in the boardroom. We should elect independent directors so that as well as being able to have, say, a minority view person's stockholder resolution come to the board of directors meeting, we ought to be able to bring in an independent slate of officers or a slate of nominees for the board so that they are no longer just the family and business associates who run the company, but some people who can bring in some outside ideas. I think the one way in which we see that functioning in a major corporation is GM and bringing of Leon Sullivan onto their board of directors, president of OIC and pastor of Zion Baptist Church in Philadelphia. And one of the first things he did was to offer up the Sullivan principles for corporate relationships in South Africa. Economic democracy in the marketplace. We need to have a Small Business Protection Act so that corporations of X size cannot buy corporations of Y size to take in their assets, take in their ideas, take in their products until the company is milked dry and then discard it. That small businesses are the thriving part of our economy. If you heard me last night in terms of supply side, Mark Green is kind of agreeing that the entrepreneurial spirit is one of the things that keeps this country alive, and that we ought to protect that entrepreneurial spirit so that major corporations just can't buy up good ideas and good companies. Economic democracy in the community. Companies who are contemplating the shutdown of a plant ought to give communities shutdown notices. Having lived in a community where the international headquarters for the plant still exist, National Cash Register totally shut down their entire manufacturing process in Dayton over a 9-month period with next to no warning, so that all the manual cash registers that NCR used to make were all made in Dayton. And when they moved to electronics, they were all made in plant sites outside of the Dayton metropolitan area. And where those plants now once stood, we have a nice green space, because they not only took the jobs away, they tore the buildings down. Well, a town the size of Dayton can kind of absorb 4,000 workers. It takes a little while, and obviously they put in an employment office to kind of refer people to other jobs. But less than 2 years after that was completed, General Motors closed down the Frigidaire plant. Frigidaire appliances were sold to the White Motor Company, and the entire manufacturing division for washers, dishwashers, dryers, refrigerators, stoves were all removed from the Dayton scene. The effective number of employees was somewhere around 9,000. Fortunately for us, GM decided that they were going to use the facilities for other kinds of purposes. They put in an S10 truck plant, and they also build diesel engines for small pickup trucks. But where there was once jobs for 9,000 people, there are now jobs for 5,000. That's a cumulative total of 8,000 people out of work in the space of about 4.5 years' time. Economic democracy, according to Mark Green, ought to say that a company has the responsibility to tell a community at least 2 years in advance that the plant will be closed, which gives the community some time to restructure itself and to prepare itself for that kind of downturn in its own economy. And it affects not just the tax base of a community, but it affects longer-range plans of other kinds of organizations. I serve on the board of directors for Family Service Association, which is a family counseling agency, part of the United Way. One doesn't necessarily realize that when a plant closes, that not only the tax base is going to be reduced, but when a plant consistently has a 100% participation by its employees in the United Way, that participation also disappears. And so you suffer budget cutbacks for all the United Way agencies as well. With a 2-year notice, you can kind of prepare yourself. You're never really quite ready. But there ought to be some laws on the books which ask companies to be fair to the communities in which they are a part. And if it's not possible to do it with a 2-year notice, then maybe the company ought to provide cushion payments to both the community and to the workers so that they can make adjustments in their own lifestyle. Economic democracy and development and investment. Consistently, we know within the structure of the church, one of the ways in which we have talked about divestment and other lands, we've always run up to the prudent man policy, especially as it concerns the pensions of the clergy. The pension boards are one of our primary areas of investment. And essentially they say that the prudent man law says that they must invest in the highest return for their investment dollar. The irony is the prudent man principle does some strange things to people. For instance, the Ford Pension Fund is heavily invested in housing, but it's high income, high cost housing in the Dallas, Texas area. Great return on the dollar. But when Ford was asked by the United Auto Workers to reinvest that in low-income housing in the Detroit area, they referred themselves to the prudent man policy. In other words, auto workers could not use their own pension funds to help then fund low-cost housing in the Detroit area for themselves. Many of the labor union's pension plans were invested in the J.P. Stevens Company. And the prudent man policy was also used to avoid taking monies away from the J.P. Stevens Company by selling their stock and investing it in other areas. Economic democracy needs to have a voice in the investment plans that affect the workers. There are some major areas of concern for economic democracy. One is industrial policy. We need to have an Office of Industrial Policy. Nobody thinks ahead in this country in terms of a corporate model for the country. Japan, Germany, all have offices of industrial policy where they can set goals, look ahead to the future, see what the new developments are on the horizon, which is one of the reasons why Japan was ready for semiconductors. Someone in their government saw that as a growing area and prepared the government and its budget and its government subsidies to corporations to be able to move into that area. We need to develop that kind of an office. We have problems with costing out and thinking through the existing subsidies we are already giving. It's easy to talk about subsidies to the railroads because it's a strange industry that has almost died. But we don't think about the ways in which we subsidize airlines, even by the subtle ways of making sure that all the airports in the country have the same kind of technical improvements that subsidizes air traffic. We need to be consistent about that. We need to have the ability to predict future bottlenecks and encourage prospective winners and cushion the losers. Some people are going to invest and make entrepreneurial decisions that are absolutely going to be winners. But we also need to have the kind of investment capital to make sure that that happens. And at the same time, we know that we're going to have some people who make up ideas that do not fly. And we ought to be able to cushion those who come down hard. We really have to deal with inflation. It has no one cause and no one solution. Some of the things we can look at seriously are a tax-based income policy. What it means is basically a tax code that's kind of a wedge between that keeps companies within certain guidelines in terms of wage and prices. Now, I'm not talking about wage and price controls, but trying to look at what the money supply is so that we don't, necessarily have these kind of high fluctuations to try and keep things on an even keel for a while. In the process, we need to have a wage insurance to make up the differences between the allowable wage increases and inflation. So there's an insurance policy that protects the workers so that they don't lose in the process, lose buying power. We need to look at military spending. We need an arms race that is slowed for two reasons. One is we know we can destroy ourselves and our enemy, and in the process probably destroy the life as we understand it in the Northern Hemisphere. So one reason we need to slow the arms race is survival. The second is economic survival as well. The military spending creates a demand without creating a supply. Savings. We need to deregulate the bank interest rates. We need to encourage the average person to build nest egg accounts so that you're not always taxed. Fifth line or seventh line down in the provinces, your dividends and interest, if you save any money, it goes into your income. There needs to be a ceiling on that, more than $100 or $200, depending upon whether you're filing singly or jointly, so that we encourage people to put money away so that they do invest. And also the deregulation of bank interest rates will create some competition in that particular marketplace, which has become a very sedentary and stable industry. And as we watch very carefully as they start charging us for the use of their plastic cards, which they gave us in the first place, and start charging us for seeing the paper that we write on again. And in many places across the country, you no longer see the checks that you write anymore. You just get a statement back in the mail. Wage and price controls need to be a last resort. Absolutely a last resort. They have worked in the past when we have been desperate. And that's where we need to be when we invoke those again. And we need a job program that works. We need to reduce unemployment so that we can put people into the working force. And that means spending government money to create job programs. There's no way around that. But we're going to spend the money one way or the other. We're either going to spend it on unemployment compensation or welfare payments, or we're going to spend it to put people into the productive marketplace. Now, which way are we going to bite the bullet? Whoops. He bit the bullet. Taxes need to be reduced. Loopholes, i.e., sometimes called incentives, need to be closed. We need to have a progressive rate structure that is consistent and non-changeable and non-fluctuating depending upon which administration is trying to win how many votes. We need to be able to say with our taxes that we know consistently on average what they're going to be based on our income. As it is now, depending upon which way you read the tax book this year, your taxes may go up or down, or you may find a loophole that you've missed before. We need to have a consistent and equitable way of taxing ourselves. Energy. Energy. We need safe energy options. We need to do conservation. We've done a relatively good job in terms of conserving petroleum products and cutting down our gas consumption. At the same time, we need to take some investments. We need to take some investments in solar and wind energy. We have continually given subsidies to atomic energy. At the same time, we've taken them away from solar and wind energy. One is renewable, or two are renewable, and one is not. We have to start looking seriously at what it means to be a conservationist of the resources we do have. If we have explored our resources in terms of petroleum products 90% better than the rest of the world, and we know that we have a limited supply, what that technically means for me is that once we explore that last 10%, we are going to have to increasingly buy from outside sources. Maybe it's time for us to get serious about what it is that we have available internally, as well as what other people might have available externally. We need to limit oil company acquisitions, especially of non-energy related corporations. In the past, companies have invested no more than 25% back into research and production. The other 75% has been making themselves multinational corporations with a broad base of acquisitions and companies. It might take federal regulations to say that our energy companies need to have an equal amount of investment in production and research and exploration as opposed to those investments in non-oil or energy-related fields. We need an Energy Corporation of America, a kind of a personal research and development arm. A good deal of our natural resources, which are expendable, like coal and oil, are owned by interlocking companies and interlocking corporations. One of the strangest things to see the Reagan administration do was to cut back on shale oil development. One is, most of the shale oil is also owned by companies who are pumping it out of the ground. If we continually cut back on research and development in those particular areas that we know we have available to us and only rely on the ones that are tried and true, that we continually box ourselves in. And maybe we need, if the companies are not going to do it, then create agencies which will do that kind of research and development for us. We also may want to do a federal import authority. Why is it that Exxon, Ohio, Shell, Texaco, when they go out and buy oil on the open market from OPEC, are competing against one another? If Saudi Arabia has a boatload of oil, and it's coming to this country, we have companies in this country who are bidding on it against each other. If we're worried about a consistent pricing of oil imports, then maybe it might be helpful if the government bought all the oil imported and then in turn sold it back to companies in this country so that there's only one bidder on this side of the Atlantic for what has become an extremely scarce resource. We have to stop regional rivalries because they add to inflation. We have to stop the tax break war that goes on between the states. One of the ways in which that happens is severance tax. Oil-producing states in the Midwest and the South have a severance tax on the oil that leaves their state to go to other states, i.e. the Northeast, because that's taking a natural resource out of their ground that they no longer have control over. At the same time, that severance tax, which those states are putting on oil exports to other states, is used then to reduce the tax benefits or the tax liability of the citizens of that state. Which means they can in turn then say, well, we can give corporations a tax break of 10 to 20 years by moving from the Northeast to the Southwest. So the people in the Northeast lose doubly. One is they lose by the taxation that they have to pay in terms of the severance tax, but then they also lose their tax base as corporations relocate to the Sun Belt. One of the other areas in which that kind of state interstate warfare is going to take place is on the issue of water. The Northeast and the Midwest have it. The Southwest does not. And if we continue the fratricide that's going to take place, it can divide the country in very serious kinds of ways. Maybe one of the things we need to do is have federal minimum standards in certain areas of our life, like the environment, labor, welfare cost, hospital cost, corporate governance, so that in the process, people cannot leave one state to get a better break in another state. It seems kind of ludicrous that certain corporations in some states pay absolutely no corporate tax, because they can work it around through state laws and state tax loopholes to say that they made no profit. Companies do not exist if they make no profit. It's as simple as all that. But because of the multitude of different state laws, corporations can find the states that are most favorable to their particular industry. If we're going to do all that kind of regulation on a national level, then we've got to make government work as well. We've got to start looking at unit costs, something that George Gilder talked about. And maybe one of the ways in which we can do that is to depoliticize the federal government. I think the best thing that could happen to the Office of Management and Budget if we got a Democrat in the next time is to keep David Stockman. The previous administrator of Office of Management and Budget just kind of let it go. We never heard about it. We never even knew there was the office. But occasionally we find people who operate in civil service who make an office work. And that's to depoliticize government offices. Find people who are creative, who have the skills and ability to do that office and do it well, and put them in the job to work. We also need to reduce duplication. In the area of food alone, we sometimes find the EPA, the CPSC, the FDA, OSHA, the Food Safety and Quality Service Department of the Department of Agriculture all operating in the same area. Jimmy Carter's tried to do some of that in the last part of his administration to reduce the government duplication in terms of regulations and investigations and try to get them to share information as opposed to fighting each other for the same pieces of information. We need to do more of that to make government as efficient as the way in which we expect business to be efficient. And maybe to make government work, we need to enforce public health laws, OSHA, and Department of Transportation laws. The laws help us. Airbags save people's lives. The Department of Transportation can prove that. But if we continually say that we're not going to wear seatbelts, we're not going to do that, then we are risking the rate of death of 140 lives per day in this country, most of whom will be under the age of 34. That's like losing a 727 crash daily. I was surprised when I found out that Canadian law requires you to wear your seatbelt. If you're not wearing it, the Canadian Highway Patrol can pull you over. different kind of law for a different country. We have special interest groups, no doubt about it. But we need to start looking at how it is those special interest groups affect our legislative bodies, congressmen, senators, etc. Maybe one of the ways in which we need to do that is look at the whole public financing of not only the presidential campaign, but of other campaigns as well. It may open it up to some of us who have no money. Lots of ideas, but no money. We need to say that televisions and radio stations ought to offer free time to candidates. The major expense of a campaign for any political office is radio and television advertising time. And if the public airwaves are owned by the public, then why are we paying to use the airwaves? There's the possibility that we may need to do some limiting of political action committee donations to individual candidates to a set amount. And in the process of the special interest groups, we need to have some consumer advocacy so that special interest groups are not the only source of information about issues. We need to have access to agencies of government. We need to have access to the courts. We need to have access for freedom of information. All of which we can offer individual cases in which they have been cut back. One case in particular involves some chemical damage to a lakeside resort area in upstate New York. All the individuals on the lakeside put together a civil suit in which all of them were involved. But those which had claims of $10,000 were the only ones acted upon by the court. So if your claim was less than $10,000, you were dismissed as a plaintiff. The Freedom of Information Act is being changed so that you may have only one request per agency per year. The Reagan administration has asked that the time used in terms of responding to requests for information be slowed down. And I guess it's the state of Massachusetts or Wisconsin or Massachusetts, which has a new state law which says that their utility must offer the consumers the opportunity to talk back. So that in a mailing last year, they surprised consumers, which says, please read the enclosed notice before reading your bill. And it raised questions about the utilities of companies' approach to wanting to raise rates and raise profits so that they could interest new investors in the public utility. And the utility company, by state law, was forced to also offer information about their opponents to that raise. I found that a unique kind of way of asking the utility company to serve you. They have to pay the postage both ways. But we need some consumer advocacy to keep consumers informed. The environment. Well, we need to personalize some of the abstractions. We've done that in terms of television and in terms of Lois Gibbs. The strange little lady who was concerned about the health of her two kids and the health of neighborhood kids in the Love Canal area of Niagara Falls, New York. And if you've watched a television show, it may not be an accurate presentation of who Lois Gibbs was or what the Love Canal was all about, but it showed the pain of one person who finally got a little upset and decided to do something about it. We need to have a national preventative cancer policy. It's one of our primary killers. We need to attack it as best we can as a country. And not just by donations to the Cancer Fund, but to take a concerted effort at what it does to all of our life in all of its ways, which involves the EPA, pollution standards, across the board. You can start just laying out the list. And we need to do something about welfare. We need to dispel myths. Those who are on food stamps are asked to spend 44 cents per person per meal. That's what food stamps gives to them. Now, if you think that that's some kind of extra special living, you ought to try it sometime. And maybe you'll understand why some people do a little hedging, maybe have a part-time job on the side. If you could live on 44 cents per meal per person per day, then I wish everyone luck. We need to take credit for fighting poverty and sometimes beating it in some places. Some of our programs have had some success stories. We ought to talk about those as well. That dispels the myths about what welfare is. And we ought to know that being anti-welfare sometimes equals being pro-crime. One of the things that George Gilder says in his book is that people seek a sense of dignity in what it is that they do for a living. And a sense of dignity is not offered by the welfare system. A sense of dignity sometimes is not offered by just being jobless and not going into the welfare system. But a sense of dignity is offered to a person who has a little bit of money in their pocket. And if one of the ways in which they can achieve dignity is by stealing or robbing, then that creates a sense of dignity for them. Not helping people by creating jobs or creating means in which they can get on their feet and then out of the welfare system sometimes can mean that we are then pro-crime, because we force people into a position where they feel the most dignified choice is to do something illegal. We need to oppose block grants. Block grants go to states. States tend to be continually inequitable. There is no consistent pattern how states fund programs across the country. And if we don't oppose block grants, we will find that we will start seeing mass migrations of people to the states who do better than other states. And some states may see their block grant message as reducing welfare to chase those people out of their states, which means then we will have a rogue class of welfare citizens. We may once again see people hopping freight trains, trying to get to some place where it comes down a little easier and a little better. We need to fight fraud in welfare. In 1978, a study was done that said that 13.9% of the welfare cases for AFDC, Aid for Dependent Children, were found to be fraudulent. They were receiving more money than they were due. At the same time, that same study found that 5.1% of the AFDC recipients were receiving less than they were actually due. So the net result was that less than 10% of the cases studied at that point in time were fraudulent. We need to have incremental and comprehensive welfare reform. We need to get ourselves out of that box and offer people a way of dignity. No one cause, no one solution. Healthcare. We need to look at competition and catastrophic insurance. One of the ways in which that is, I see that very personally, is the way in which the Lutheran Church in America has their pension fund and their health benefits plan for ministers. It's a deductible policy, which means I don't turn around every time my kid has a sniffle and run to the doctor or run into the emergency room of a hospital. I become very selective about making sure that I've got to spend $17 to take him to the doctor, because I know the first 10 times I take my wife and my kids and myself to the doctor, I have to pay for it. So if I take him 17 times plus the prescriptions, that's about $200. That's my deductible. And they don't pay until after the deductible's paid. We need to look at self-insurance. Some companies are doing that now with some degrees of success. We need to look at wellness programs, which don't necessarily operate after someone is ill, but it really starts talking about the whole process in which a company's employees maintain their health. Some companies do that by recreational facilities, advanced physicals per year, physicals for executives, so that they start looking in advance as to what the potential problems might be and find ways to avoid those problems. We need to look at cost containment. The cost of medical care continues to skyrocket. While the doctor said last night that CAT scans are no longer regulated by the federal government, many state and regional hospital associations are regulating the number of new equipment brought into an area so that hospitals start sharing their expertise as opposed to every hospital having everything. We need to look at health maintenance organizations. Some in some states are working extremely well. Some in others are not working as well. They are essentially pre-planned, prepaid medical plans. Massachusetts has a cap and contract system for their Medicare. They put a cap on the amount that the state is going to spend for medical expenses, and then they tell the doctors, we're going to pay you X amount of dollars for the year. And then the doctors have to serve the people. It may mean more serious looking at what it involves in a person's problem, so that the person doesn't get a cursory examination, but they get a full examination, because that one examination may be all that they can afford. And at the same time, if a person really has something serious, then those costs are built into the already capped ceiling that the state will pay for Medicare. And the doctors are already prepaid. They're paid at the beginning of the year, not on a case-by-case basis. Something to look at. We need to look at physician's extenders, doctor's assistants, midwives, and other ways in which medical care can be offered to people at less cost. One of the strange things he talked about was the cigarette excise tax. If there's a 10% rise in the cost of cigarettes, there's a 12% decrease in the number of teenagers who begin to smoke. And over 80% of most people start smoking before they're 20. I'm not sure North Carolinians would feel good about that. And at the same time, he says we ought to really investigate a national health insurance. I've got four more, and then we'll be finished, and we can start into the dialogue. Housing. We need to shelter people and not taxes. We need to look at repairing of old buildings before we build new. We need to have neighborhood housing services in which we look at neighborhoods as entities which have a life of their own. And we need to keep neighborhoods viable. And if that means somehow offering specialized low-cost loans for rehabbing houses in neighborhoods, we ought to be looking at that as well as building new houses in outlying areas. We ought to have an anti-speculation tax. The regentrification of older neighborhoods in central cities has driven the low-income homeowners out of their old neighborhoods. And a lot of that has been done on re-speculation, buying a cost at X number of dollars, rehabbing it, and selling it at a much higher price. We need to talk seriously about a housing corporation, or cooperatives. Not only do you have apartment co-ops where the apartments can only be sold in certain ranges to certain kinds of income types and certain legal laws that the corporation puts together, but we may want to talk about neighborhood housing cooperatives so that there is a fair and equitable way in which we can talk about an increase on the value of your home while you're living in it, but not so much driving it out of the price range so that other people in that neighborhood cannot buy houses. Nuclear power. Accidents will happen and have happened. It's been 30 years that we've been in the nuclear business, and we still have no definitive way to deal with waste. We have no sure solutions. We really ought to take away the subsidies we are putting into nuclear energy and put it in other alternatives which do not cause the same kind of waste problem. Crime. We need to have swift, sure, and short punishment. I thought that was rather strange. But if it's swift, short, and sure, you don't have long litigations, you don't have plea bargaining, and you don't have people necessarily finding themselves, arguing themselves, or postponing it often enough that the right people don't show up at the right time and somehow you get them off anyway. We need to find some alternatives to incarceration. If there are work programs in which we can put people who commit crimes to repay back those who are offended, those who are hurt, and also to help themselves and the society in the process, maybe that might be a much more viable alternative than housing them in warehouses. In terms of crime, we need to look at community self-help programs. Neighborhood watches and neighborhood block clubs are always the least likely neighborhoods to be hit. A professional criminal will tell you that if there's a neighborhood watch sign, he's much more leery about going into that neighborhood than he is one without it. When we look out for our neighbors, we also look out for ourselves. Mark Green also suggests that we ought to look seriously at gun control. Not long guns, but short guns. Short guns kill people. Short guns are in plentiful supply. Short guns are what creates our news reports on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings. And if we're concerned about crime in the street, then we ought to be concerned about sweet crime. That's S-U-I-T-E. You see, because justice must be colorblind as well. The kind of crime that takes place in the office suites ought to be dealt with the same swift, short justice that is street crime. When corporations are found being guilty of breaking the law, then those consumers ought to be informed. When executives are found guilty of breaking the law, they ought to be barred from working in that same kind of industry or the same kind of job for a reasonable time in the future. When government officials are found guilty of breaking the law, they ought to be dealt with in the same way that people are when it is street crime. I'll stop there. There's more about welfare and older folks and aged, but I can kind of do that off the hand. Any questions?
For, say, nonviolent types of crimes and stuff, we've just been through a situation, and it was like the alternatives. There were no alternatives other than incarceration, and it was like the judge, and he's really a respected judge, and it just. I think he was trying to do a real fair thing, but it was like nothing else was thought of, and I felt like it was a waste and a detriment to society and to the individual involved. I mean, it was not even a question of whether or not a crime against society had taken place, if you decided that it had. But it seemed like a real waste, and I was just curious if there was a movement or anything.
There, and one of the things that Mark Green does in his prescriptive part of the book is give you names and addresses of agencies, coalitions, which are working in those particular kinds of areas. A lot about alternative punishment takes place in terms of what your state laws will accept. So that's partly where you have to start. What is it that your state will accept as ways of looking at the issues of punishment for crimes? Which may say writing to something, even to your state legislators, find out what it is the state legislature is doing about alternative punishments to incarceration. But there's the Citizens Action on Crime in New York, Citizens Crime Commission National Association in Atlanta, Georgia, the Fortune Society in New York, the National Center for Institutions and Alternatives in Washington, D.C., the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, and the Vera Institute of Justice in New York. That's one of the neat things about the book. If you want information, he gives you definitive places to write, and also then a list of bibliography of other places to turn for other writings in that same area. That's one of the harder problems, because in a lot of my state in particular, Ohio has now approved the building of 7 new smaller prisons, one of whom will be 3 blocks or about 13 blocks from the church that I'm a member of, after a lot of fighting by the residents in the neighborhood that they didn't want a prison in their backyard. And there will be a number of folks who can look out of their front porches and see the prison.
It seems to me that there's a different kind of understanding of democracy when you talk about economic democracy in this context. It sounds very different from what is being talked about continually on our local radio station, there's a program called From Another Point of View, and he keeps reiterating that what is needed is less and less in terms of governmental control, and what you're talking about is essentially more governmental control in many areas.
In some areas, yes. In some areas,
yeah.
Less.
Yeah.
But to have a consistent national policy would be helpful in some particular areas.
Yeah.
You know, as much as states fought the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, generally, except when we got to Wyoming, when a truck passed me doing 70, and I looked like I was going the other way. most people, you know, abide by the 55 speed limit. My particular state, you know, truckers will tell you, slow down when you hit Ohio. First offense is $50. Second is $100. And in the process, and we have saved in consumption of gas and other oil products.
Saved a
lot of people's lives. So, you know, if there are some areas that we can point to that say a national policy is helpful across the board without any kind of argument, then those are the areas we ought to look seriously at that about. If there are ways in which we can talk about national guidelines for corporate law and corporate taxation, then that gets it out of the state hands, and companies don't, you know, jump around from state to state for their national headquarters to find out where's the best state that gives them the best deal.
We're doing things like in this state where Boeing conveniently delivers its planes in Portland that doesn't have a sales tax.
Well, it seems like he's got some real, what a lot of people would call conflicts, because, you know, you go back to venture capital and things like that, but then spending quite a bit of time on regulations that really have turned off a lot of people to capital investing the last few years. And you know, it just seems at this point you can talk about capital, but a lot of people that are potential investors, you know, have, you know, let's just take Chrysler. Over the years, you know, a fair amount of return to the company, let's say, where they perhaps were going out on wages, the stockholders weren't having anything to say about, you know, where the money was going. Chrysler was unable to keep up in maybe research and development. Not only did they get hammered by the price of the stock, but now you want people to go back in and buy the stock at $7 a share, and the first quarter that they make money, all of a sudden we've got talk of the UAW coming back in and getting a chunk of that. And you've definitely taken away a lot of people's desire to be investors.
At the same side, same time, supply side, as we experience it right now, one of the chief critics of it is Wall Street. So, you know, I'm not saying that there's one solution.
Yeah.
Like, there are a number of things we've got to look at, because what's working now and what's worked in the past may have to be blended in a different kind of formulation. Investing is a very strange commodity for me, because I always grew up thinking that if a person invested, they took the loss of winning or losing. And the place where it grates on me most is when I hear people, especially my own utility company, which has moved from the last place utility company in the Ohio region to second in terms of rate increases and rate costs, provide a minimum investment return for their stockholders. I scratch my head and go, that's not the way the system was taught to me. You weren't guaranteed a minimum investment return. You took a risk along with everybody else who took a risk. And I guess, you know, that's part of the problem, is that much of our investments have moved into non-risk-bearing places. And the only places where the risk is taking place is in some marginal banks and savings and loan associations.
If they would remove that monopoly the power company had over you, they would allow another company to come in and undercut that. If they really had a free system.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, there are some magazines here, the Crescent, which is produced by Valparaiso University, and the editorial is on, is Democratic Capitalism Morally Defensible? So you might want those. They're free for the taking.
Thank you.